Good evening and welcome to the September 21st edition of K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show. Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. Still going strong all these years later. My name's Steve Cato, and I am back in the studio again, as always, with my vigilant and now fully mobile co-host, Nicholas Miller. Nicholas,
hey, how are you doing? Oh, always good to be here with you, in vivo, in the flesh, alive and well. I look forward to many more years of the Talking Show together.
Yes, yes, as do I. It was nice. I was at the Other Places Art Fair all weekend this last week in San Pedro, in a sort of tunnel, playing clarinet. With my fellows in the Los Angeles Woodwind Skillshare, and I was happy to see that K-Chung Radio was there as well. There was a K-Chung Radio booth.
Ooh,
K-Chung Radio corporate president Evan Walsh made an appearance to just make sure that everything was going according to plan. So it was like it was nice to be like, here we are, folks, K-Chung, still running things at the outdoor events. It was quite a nice location actually for K-Chung. You were up on a hill and you could see from where you were playing the records. You could play the records directly to, the harbor, basically. Like you could just see, cause it extends all the way to your east there when you're on the hill in San Pedro. Really quite a view. So, I thought it was a lovely weekend. And it's so nice that it's cooled off a little bit in general. Wouldn't you say? How was your weekend?
It was lovely. I spent the most of Saturday with my now future in-laws.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And that was lovely. We went, they came over.
They were more or less your in-laws before.
True, but now there's talk of formalizing it. Don't worry, listeners, we don't have a date yet, but...
You're all invited.
Yeah.
If you can prove that you were listening to the show on this date, you can show up.
That's you, Mark,
the location.
So. And
and who else is going to give you away? Who else is going to be the officiant, if not Mark? So
it's true.
Think about it, actually. That's probably not a bad idea.
It's true. Yeah, they came by to inspect my art studio, which was fun. And then we went to lunch, and that lasted a long time. It was also pleasant. And then we went to former Talking Show guest, director of the Sealed Library's birthday, where I ran into Steve Cato, Jeffrey Stuker.
Steve Cato, Jeffrey Stuker, I've heard of him.
I got the commas a little mixed up there, but... But yes, it was Jeffrey Stuker's birthday, and I ran into Steve Cato, Jeffrey Stuker there.
Steve Cato, Jeffrey Stuker is also a very close friend of mine as well.
Yes.
It was a very lovely birthday for Jeff. That was a very busy day. I went to a second birthday party after that. I had just been in the sun all day in San Pedro.
Mamma mia. That's how
blowing
you like
my
it,
little
though.
Lungs out.
I feel like that's
how
true.
I'm a many things in a day kind of guy. Although, yeah. The geography is a little much, case, going from San Pedro to Pasadena is, that's really closing the loop, I mean, I guess we weren't going to Altadena. That'd be right up there, But we were just shy of going all the way.
It's true.
I was just all the way. I was just in Flint Ridge, La Cañada today, enjoying a bicycle ride, actually. So.
Oh, that sounds nice.
There's a time to get over there. I mean, it's like, I was really bummed out on the heat wave a couple weeks ago. And now that we've got this, it's just like... why do people ever live anywhere else?
Yeah.
Well, it's supposed there's a wonderful breeze outside.
The heat's supposed to come back next week.
You're not telling me the truth. You're not serious.
That's what they say.
I looking at my phone right now, audience. Sorry, it's rude to do while you're talking to someone, but I just see this for myself.
Yeah,
it's not so bad, but it's not great.
No, it's not.
Dang.
Yeah. Well, we don't have
get
any
your bike rides in while you can.
Yeah, we don't have any weather to complain about this week, but I can complain about all of these new mosquitoes Have you been? Do you have those in your neck of the woods?
We've been having them all summer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's terrible.
I read that
we don't really have working screens.
Right, and these are a new breed that recently showed up in LA last summer. They say.
That makes sense. I had some last summer too. Yeah.
Yeah.
What news? Tell us about.
I knew more. It was only hearsay. I think at the birthday party that you and I attended. But I believe that, yeah, they were brought over in some shipment of produce or something. But I find that, like, oftentimes with that kind of thing, it's always, there's some pretty heavy xenophobia going on when they try and trace where it comes from.
Yeah.
So I usually ignore that news, but I was keenly interested in them being new mosquitoes, because I don't usually associate this part of the world with mosquitoes, and they've been active en force this summer.
No, it's been a real attraction of living here is the lack of mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I know from my brush with being a Texan for a second, I know that they are a vigorous presence where you're from, and they are a significant presence in Toronto. So it's you know, it's a situation where if you don't really have many bugs around, it's kind of a luxury. But yeah, what should we do about them? I think that's more the question, right? Like, do we need to import an exotic thrush to like munch on them? What how's it work?
I have no idea.
Do we need to increase the urban bat population? How do we get rid of these fucks? I want them gone.
Me too.
What do
I
we
like
do?
Bats. Let's bring in more bats.
More bats. Well, you know what you could do is, I suppose, although the problem is that, like, birds might also choose to live in them, but I suppose we could start making bat boxes. Try to induce bats to live in our area by providing them with a bachelor shelter.
Yeah, my future aunt-in-law, is that even a term?
Uh-huh.
Keeps bats.
There's probably a specific word. Really?
Yeah, she keeps bats and bees, and is a welder. Oh, and has an amazing
two of my favorite animals.
I think you'd get along. You two would get along. She lives just outside of San Francisco, and she was a welder for Boeing for a long time, and she has incredible custom license plate on her car that says Bat Welder. I think that's her email address too. So bats and welding are her main preoccupations. Fascinating person, yeah. I thought of her because at some point when I was doing carpentry, she opened a conversation about commissioning a bat house, a custom bat house for her bats.
Uh-huh, but which is a thing.
Yeah, it didn't quite pan out. Could never agree on a budget.
Do you know how one keeps bats? Is there anything... So in conversation, have you ever sort of figured out how it works?
You know, I think they keep them inside, which is why they are their bats and not just bats.
In the house.
I believe so.
How do the bats get out?
I think they don't need to because they feed them.
Oh. So these aren't free-range bats.
Well, they might be. I'm not sure. But you'd think, like you know, if you kept a bird and had a birdhouse, maybe it would stick around for a couple weeks, but then eventually it would take off, right?
Well, it depends on the bird. I mean, like, you know, in birdhouses, oftentimes, like, during nesting season, that's when birds move in. And then at the end of the season, when the baby birds leave the nest, you know, then everyone takes off and a new family moves in.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it works. But bats form colonies, and migratory colonies, usually.
Right.
Pretty stable colonies.
So keeping bats doesn't seem that practical, I guess. But like bats do return, like perhaps her bats leave for part of the year and they always come back to her attic or something like that.
Or I mean, I think there might also be non-migratory bats. But like you know, it's like there's like a cathedrals in Europe and stuff like that. And there's a large number of bats live in those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they fly out every night and they return through you know hole openings. I guess, and sleep in the attic during the day and fly out at night. You know, I would imagine if you kept bats inside, the bats would go out during the nighttime. You know, there's like it's not fully enclosed, I guess. You'd have like a patio or something like, you know, like a terrace or pergola or something like that for the bats.
Yeah. I will ask.
To sleep in.
Our last conversation centered around... She's welding a fence for she and her husband's home out of parts from sewing machines, which sounds pretty awesome.
That sounds extremely San Francisco.
Yeah.
That's a very Bay Area sounding move.
It's true.
I would say.
Yeah. It's a far cry from the sort of architecture that I think we'll be discussing tonight, wouldn't you say, Steve?
I think that's likely true. Although, I think we might not even discuss any architecture at all.
Oh.
Today.
Oh, dear.
We might just talk to an architect. Which you'd think that would lead to a conversation about architecture. But, you know, at a certain point in everyone's life, it's time to reflect on just how things happened the way that they happened. So we're very pleased to have with us the gray eminence of English brutalism, formerly one half of the power couple, Allison and Peter Smithson, now, unfortunately, just Peter Smithson. So yes, we have famous British architect Peter Smithson here to tell us about what it was like before.
Could you tell me when and where you were born, please, Peter?
I was born in Stockton-on-Tees in 1923.
Now let's look at your early life. Do you remember your grandparents?
That's a good question, because I discover that I have very little memory of my maternal grandparents. My mother's father was a steelworker. And in the before 1888, when they made education compulsory, my mother would be born after that, and her father therefore before that. Therefore, they bought working people who had to teach themselves to read, and my grandmother, who I do remember, could read. But whether she'd learned as a grown-up or not. But he must have died fairly young, leaving my maternal grandmother, who lived alone the whole time I knew her, apart from one of my cousins lived with her part of the time.
Was that close to you in Stockton?
Yes. I think my mother was born in a street called Paradise Row, which in the time that late 18th, early 19th century, there was a smart part of the town, you know, with Georgian-type three-story houses. And the church is 17th century, which I think when industry came in that direction in 19th century gradually went downhill, and I imagine that she was born into a room or several rooms in one of those houses. I've never, you know, the usual thing. Your curiosity is too late. I'm sure you've discovered that.
Yes.
Is that, you know, you suddenly think, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to know? And the people are dead. You know. And they lived within walking, she lived, my grandmother, within walking distance for a small child. Though there was very little communication between my mother and her mother, again, might be normal.
But you don't think there was any animosity between them? That was, or do you?
Yes, I think in a way that, you know, my mother was. Puritan, in a sense, you know, and that my paternal grandfather was a primitive Methodist, and in childhood that was the chapel that I went to, and of course they were like the Quakers, antagonistic to, you know, drinking and gambling and so on, whereas the steel workers are the word is not boozy, you know, but their work makes drinking normal to them, and I think probably my mother found in her father's, though the little bit I knew about him, he himself was very abstemious, etc., you know. But you know, you again, to repeat, you don't, it doesn't come to you until too late to ask the questions about that kind of thing. In the case of my other grandfather, because my father worked for him.
Your father worked for his father?
Yes.
And did he do?
Well, I looked up his marriage certificate, and it said commercial traveller, brackets, drapery. Though, in fact, the firm, Smithson and Chalder, it said on the notepaper, hardware and software. And as a child, software was shirts and things like that, which they sold in village shops. And the hardware was brooms and leathers, you know, window leathers, and the smell was wonderful, you know, I mean, for a child.
So you visited the shop regularly, did you?
Yes. That I suppose on Saturday mornings, you see, people worked Saturday mornings in the 20s and 30s, under 40s, in fact, that I would probably go with, well, I'm sure I went with my father, to the warehouse, and whilst he did whatever he did, you know, banking up for the week or whatever, you know, I would just snuffle about. And memory, that it had bells, which is the best bit, you know, in what was once the kitchen. There were bells in every room that still worked, you know, so you could, like in Kensington, most houses have the remnants of that system, but it, as the bells were all there, you know, you could rush about playing.
Splendid.
And the back, I suppose, it was you, I mean, we're back to the yard business, that the front of the warehouse, which had been another 18th century, early 19th century house, originally had a garden, and the back was the back street, on which accessed into a yard, which accessed presumably originally into the kitchen areas, which was then used as packing space. And I knew that grandfather certainly by sight very well. He was a very dapper man, small, and he, you know, had always had a carnation in his buttonhole in a silver thing, you know, where my grandfather. You know, where you see a little circle of silver here, and there's a little water container behind.
So he was wealthy, was he?
He was reasonably well off, yes. I mean, that is, he lived in a in the best part of the town, you might say, in a house with a garden and a greenhouse and a gardener. And my father's mother died when he was a child. There were three brothers, one of whom became a designer of ship's engines with Smith's Dock, the ship. They're all defunct now. And the other, a chemist, pharmaceutical chemist, a chemist with a chemist shop. And I suppose my father was the only one who hadn't any education beyond the time, you know, there was all then. I don't know whether secondary school was compulsory or not, but, you know, they went on until they were 15 or so.
Or 14, and
then my mother became a student teacher, you know, where you stay on,
yes.
And then you then become yourself, I suppose, at 19, a teacher in a primary school, what it would then be called infants.
So your mother had moved away from her parents in the sense that she was obviously
well.
Yeah,
I mean, this is why I was timid in when you asked me whether there was any antagonism, you know. I mean, that you never know whether the you know, those exchanges about books and ideas that are common to the lower middle classes, that you she found it difficult to bridge with her mother, who would never read a book, you know, but that's an assumption. That was hard for her, because I mean, the one thing I do remember her saying was when her first job, which was at Stillington, that she didn't make enough money to, she still had to borrow money from her father to live, although she bicycled, and it was quite a long way to the school, so that the young teachers were obviously paid very little. I mean, probably not as much as a girl working in a shop, you know. So that, and I, again, a thing I'm not perfectly sure of, when I went to the infant school, I think it was the infant school at which she taught before I was born. Well, of course, that had a certain influence on me, obviously, because up to the age of 11, which was when the scholarship exams were then, you know, the 11 plus thing, it became later. In the subjects that she knew about, which I suppose was English, probably only English. I mean, one got a certain amount of home coaching, as my children get home coaching, you know, that is, in the subject their parents know about. Therefore, when came the 11 plus time, the scholarship year, college, that I had a scholarship, both, not a scholarship, an entry possibility into either the grammar school or the secondary school where both my parents had been, which meant they were both free, though in the grammar school you could pay. I don't know where the money came from for the grammar school. I mean, whether they had their own funds or a non-pay pupil. And you stop me when my narrative is misdirected from your point of view. And come the 15 years when one sat the school certificate, was 1939, the year the war started.
Yes, I mean, we've travelled on a long way from there, and I'm still mentally with your
grandparent,
early life.
Yeah.
Yes, I've built up a picture of your mother coming from a slightly different class than your father, at least in wealth terms.
Yes, I wonder whether I think they probably felt that quite strongly at the time, you know, because the.
How did your parents meet?
I don't know that either. They played mixed hockey together. You know, I mean, you never know. And the photographs reveal very little. That is, certainly there's no difference between my mother's dress and my father's. But whether she's already by her mid-20s consciously removed herself from a working-class family, because, you know, I mean, the men were all in high collars and shooting jackets, and the women all in long dresses. And, of course, they then... accommodated themselves, that's the right word, to the fashions of the period, you know,
yes.
Walking and sports, and, you know, just sort of three men in a boat period, you know, where that social class, you know, clerks and so on, were, well, the jump to the next jump was so enormous, you know what I mean, because the local big house, you know, seemed, you know, unbelievably far distant. It is Wynyard Park, where the Londonderrys lived.
And did you ever go there?
Yes, because it was open on bank holidays to anybody as a gift from them to the... You know, it was where Macmillan was there, where he stayed when he came to Stockton. I mean, probably his wife was related to the Londonderrys. Well, I've forgotten what their family name is. But that was a, you know, parenthesis about... You can't measure at this distance the difference between the social classes, it seems to me. Because there were the huge jumps. And I did a similar thing to this last week. You know, I said, well, I never travelled until the army made me travel. Because only people of the, I'm quoting myself, of the, what did I call them, the solicitor class would travel abroad. Do you see? I mean, a schoolmaster wouldn't travel. I mean, there was this next jump, you know, which was a few professionals in the town. And although the children mixed to a certain extent, you know, that is, the people who went away to school joined the people who didn't go away to school and holidays, you know, but it wasn't such a rigid class division. Probably less rigid than it is now, you know.
That's interesting.
And it is interesting, because my... difficult to tell, isn't it?
What was the position that your father held at the top of his career?
He was just a worker for my father, you know, and continued to be so for all his life, because when my grandfather died, the assumption was that my father would inherit the firm, you know, but it didn't happen that way. He made a will to his second wife, my mother having died, you see. So, in a sense that... I suppose what effect had that on me? Just to... try to be reasonably generous to my own children. You know, I mean, my father always said, well, when I came home from the war, from being a soldier, you know, my father made me pay back to him the little money he'd lent me when I was earning a shilling a day. I mean, there was that aspect of antagonism between his father and himself, which, I've been thinking about the interview. You know, my grandfather, when we were in chapel, we had on the balcony, in the same pew. Presumably, it was a paid-for pew. But when I went with my parents, he used to give me 2 and 6 pence. Well, that was in the time when a working man would get £2 a week.
Mm.
Well, that's an eighth of his salary. Well, if you take an eighth of current working man's salary, you get something like 25-30, which is a fantastic tip for a little boy.
Yes,
you know, that is probably an aspect of show off in him, you know, whereas he wouldn't be generous to his own children, but he would be generous to his grandchildren.
You said when you went to church with him, I mean...
Chapel,
quite right, very different. He would give you this money. Did he only give it to you when you went to church, to chapel?
I don't remember anything about birthday presents or... from my grandparents at all.
Was that the only time he saw you in chapel?
Yes, probably.
I
mean, very occasionally we went to tea on a Sunday, in which the one abiding memory, which I suppose every child has, is that I was given seed cake, you know, and I thought it was dirty, and I wouldn't eat it, you know. And then everybody laughs. And it's so painful, you know, that I relive it frequently. And, you know, why am I eating this cake with bits of dirt in it? You know? But they were very formal, I think, you see, what's missing is the obverse, that is my maternal father, I'm sure was a very entertaining, I don't mean funny, but a kind person, very easily able to communicate with young children.
And
I suppose he probably died at 68 or so.
But you
again, I don't. You know, it's too late to find out. But there are pictures of me with him, and I'm in a pram, and he's pushing it. But I don't want to embark on things that are based on false memory.
Exactly, yes.
Because, photography, unfortunately, Fortunately, in one sense, it provides an accurate picture of a period. Unfortunately, that it provides people with something they think they can remember.
That's you know, true.
And it's wrong to say, well, I remember my grandfather wearing such and such and being like that, because you don't. It's what you pick up from photographs.
Very
but
true.
I remember him being kind. That's homely. Like one of my own children is very easy with his nieces and nephews. You know, I mean, they are friends immediately. And it's partly a gift and partly a conscious act, you know, of identifying downward.
Was the primitive Methodist chapel, was this a very large part in your life as a child?
Not really, and I think it probably stopped when I was 7 or so, because my parents left the chapel. I mean, and again, you never know whether it was due to antagonism, and became theosophists. So I was brought up in a kind of New Woman way, you know, a theosophist and vegetarian and, you know, under the influence of Annie Besant and that, you know, which would mean that it was before, I mean, I was born in the 20s, but I think that movement started before the First War, because you know, the story about Edwin Lutyens, the Edwardian architect, was married to Emily Lutyens, you know, at the same time he was building the Viceregal Lodge. She was running around with the Indian theosophists and anti-imperialists and so on, which therefore that period of building started before the First War. Therefore it's we're talking about the period between 1910 and 1925, say, or 1930. And they continued to be theosophists the whole of my life.
So, I mean, this
is
amazing.
And that is, well, I just finished that strobe. Which means, instead of chapel, you go to a series of, you know, a meeting, say, once a month. But they have a quasi-religious. But it's not. It's not, yes. It's pantheistic, I suppose is the word, you know, all religions are equal. It's not like Quakerism, it's just another form of Christianity, you know.
That was a very major change for your parents to make.
Yeah, and might be conscious, you see. I mean, jumping well, again, you have to have a little bit which is not direct memory, but I was reading the only famous man that ever came from Stockton-on-Tees is the man that invented the safety match, not the safety match, the match. That means so you could have a light whenever you wanted. And next to the history of the railways or something, there was a little pamphlet shoved in, which must have come from my parents' library. About this man. And it had a line of, it was a before the railway. The railways came 1825. That it said at the time that though the man who invented the matches was a pharmacist, and you know the farmers and the gentry came in as well, but the town was in at that time was in a very low condition. Now, I'm not sure exactly why, but probably the fooling around with the navigation on the Tees had moved a lot of the trade further down. But at that moment, I sensed that it had began to stop being a market town for the countryside and became a bit of a kind of depressed industrial town. Well, of course, when I was a child, the 30s, it was, you know, it had the most unemployment, the whole
depression.
Macmillan period. So that probably that to escape from the depression of the period, I mean, I'm trying to explain why theosophy, you know, to experience an enlightenment which wasn't Christian.
Yes.
And removed you from the really day-to-day squalor, because all those industrial towns like Middlesbrough, West Hartlepool and Thornaby, you know, they were not only dirty, because if 1825 was the first railway, by 1925, you know, they'd had 100 years of steam locomotion, and they were dirty, and there wasn't any money about for cleaning them, you know, in the municipality. Therefore, you had two escapes. One was to, you know, walking in the moors, the North Yorkshire moors. And the other was escape into a. I mean, I'm unable to explain why they chose theosophy. I mean, it might have been that was like the new art, which was it was in the air, you know. Like, why did, you know, why?
So this whole new regime that you remember being vegetarian and so
yeah.
on, how did that affect you?
Not much, I don't think, because you see, my best friend, who was in the class above me at school, that his mother and my mother had been friends before we were born, they were also, though much stricter, were vegetarians and theosophists and so on. I lived in a bit of a cocoon of that, as presumably all children do. You know, my regular story that in our back street you can get access here to another street, and there was doctors' children. One of my children used to go to play with, and she came back one day having had tea there and said, did you know, I mean, they're allowed to sit in any place, that table. You see, I mean, you're within the pattern of your home, which is repeated in the other home of people you know, and then you jump a tiny distance out of one social scene into the other. I put it made me dislike the smell of cooking meat, because it was so strange to me. And of course, it made me conscious of accent to...
How do you mean?
Well, my mother would have taught herself to speak properly, being a school teacher. And therefore, in our little street, there were, you know, lodgers from this grammar school, train drivers, clerks in the insurance office, you know, was a very mixed thing. And of course, within that, there were a vast range of accent and precision of speech. And I suppose I it's interesting, it's almost like confessional, isn't it? I mean, you know, the squalor of the poorest parts of the town, you know, all dog shit and paper blowing about, I equated with the coarsest regional accent, the coarsest town accent, because it's very, very, it's not a not Geordie, you know, and it varies from Darlington to Stockton to Thornaby to whatnot. You can tell immediately where people are from, you know. And I think that their attempt to be more genteel, which probably made me read the town differently. But, you know, one's never very... You're not very conscious.
Well, no, it's only later when you look back.
It's only when you look back, and then to repeat for the third time, you then think, well... I should ask my cousin about that, you know, and they're not there, you know. Mm. So I say, whether you're trying to validate your memory.
So,
but I think I struggle to stray with real memory, you know.
Well, moving to you then, I mean, do you believe in another God or another religion or...
No, I think this is the only life. You know, so I mean, this is paradise. You know. No, I've had an extremely good life.
And do you believe in any other dimension at all?
I mean, all the difficulty in separating belief from I can't find the word for it, custom, you know, that is the...
Do you attend
the churches represent, for me, nationality, you know, they are... I mean, you're very conscious how tied in they are with the nature of the folk in which they're... And it's an expression of... the tribe, you know, and it got being so that, well, you have to have another level, two or three more levels of complication. After maybe I was seven or eight, I was moved from the primary school, the infant school, to another infant school in the far away other end of the town, which was called Holy Trinity Higher Grade School.
Why was that?
Don't know why. Presumably because they thought it. From that school you stood a better chance of getting a scholarship. But it was Church of England school, and of course the grammar school to which, of the two schools that I could have gone to, my parents sent me to, was also attached to the town, the parish church, and we had preparation for acceptance into the church.
Do you mean confirmation?
I do confirmation classes, but for some, I can't remember why, I was never confirmed. But presumably because I was probably not under any pressure not to, but there was a sort of negative. I can't remember anything about why not. All I can remember is parentheses about embedded in one is all the ritual and the hymns of the church.
Yes, I see.
Which I still find incredibly moving, you know. And that is, and of course all architects spend their lives visiting churches. Because you see, architecture, you know, when you first questions about the yard, and I say it was free from architectonic consideration.
Yes, of course, we must just explain for the tape that you're giving a talk later in the week, because that wasn't on the tape. So you're going to discuss the yard.
Well, I'm trying to differentiate between a class of things or spaces which are imbued with notions that are not practical. You know, and of course, the church is one of the repositories of all those geometric devices which correspond to the cosmology of the period. You know, the circular church comes at a time when the thought that geometry was sacred in itself, you know, proportion and so on, and the Gothic, you know, I mean, it's classic. I mean, the grandfather, great-grandfather of Prince Charles, who created the land on which he was sitting. But, you know, in his time, the Gothic revival was all. And, of course, Charles puts false pilasters on an ordinary house, and he got married in St. Paul's, which is an appalling building, you know, I mean, because it's classical, you know, I mean, yes. There's a swing of... But each of them... I don't know how I got involved in explaining this, but each of them is concerned with issues which are not practical, you know. How did we begin on this?
Well, we were talking about what religion meant to you,
and you were differentiating between the feeling
and the building, and the custom that goes with it.
Yes, no, I'm an I'm an Anglican by
adoption.
Feeling, adoption.
Oh, feeling.
Yeah, by feeling.
By feeling. You know, okay.
But you see, you become so critical of the arguments, and of course, you can't accept the 39 article. You know, I mean, there's a whole level of. And of course, there's one also professional, intellectual, which now in old age, makes it very difficult to go to a lecture because. You've read all the books that the guy that you know, and often they have nothing more. And similarly in church, you can follow the logic too easily, you know. So, yes,
right.
you pick me up very well. Thank you. That is that to be an Anglican by adoption is to fall in love with one's own country, in my view.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point.
And I'm sure this is the Betjeman sort of religion. I mean, sure, if he was here, he's less intelligent than I am, but he would say the same thing in better words. Yeah.
Okay, so you moved from one primary school to another.
Yes.
Was that hard?
To go to church. We had to go to service. Was it in the weekday? Was a neo-Gothic Revival church, sort of after street.
Were you even at that time looking at the buildings?
I think I could differentiate between Gothic Revival and real Gothic.
Well, I think that's pretty good for primary school child.
Yes. And I was used to looking at buildings, you know.
Why was that?
My father liked looking at me. My father used to draw, and you know, you get a lot of input from your parents. I mean, the fact that they look at buildings, and on we do bicycle ride, we always went to churches. I mean, again, it all sounds like Betjeman, but
did you draw as well, even as
not at age? That age, no. But, and I think also my father would never go out alone to draw. I think he was, as I am, I'm embarrassed by incompetence. You know, one doesn't draw well enough. Therefore, you like to be alone so that you can scrap the drawing, you know. And
how did you feel about leaving all your friends in the first primary school? Did that worry you, or did you make
new
friends?
No, I don't remember anything. Right. Nothing
okay.
at all.
I just wondered if you made, if you thought you made friends easily.
No, I think probably there's one friend who was at the grammar school with me, though in a different class, was also in the same primary school, the first primary school with me, though I don't remember that.
So
but I'm very get on. I haven't seen him for 2 or 3 years, but he's the one. The friends when both the mothers were friends before the children were born has remained my one friend through life, because all the other friends have been made subsequently. And all the others are to do with one discipline. I have no friends outside. I have very few friends.
Why do you think
particularly
that's
amongst the sound recording fraternity.
You're just making one
yes,
now.
Yes. Yeah.
Why do you think that you say you have very few friends very emphatically?
Well, it's a very demanding discipline. I mean, when Alice and I were in our 20s, I mean, we worked in a 3-period day. We would draw after dinner, even when the children were existed. Therefore, you really have no time outside reading and drawing. And it's still the same. You know, I don't do anything else.
Okay. Well, tell me about going to the grammar school. You did win a scholarship,
yes,
which was excellent.
Well, I suppose it was a scholarship. Yes. Yes, I was a scholarship boy, yes, quite so. Yes.
And how did you find the grammar school?
It was very harsh, you know.
What was the name of the grammar school?
The Grammar School, Stockton-on-Tees. Still exists, but it's in a building in the suburbs, built in the post-war period. And then it was in the town, in a very rackety the school that existed from the 18th century, you know, but it was in a decayed part of the town. small, 108, 150, 180 pupils. And I suppose there were classes of 36, threes, or 18, that's right, with a sixth form. But just one class in each year. And I was very slow, you know, which, and, you know, we had compulsory Latin and French every day, sometimes two periods. And I got no verbal memory, you know, and I found that very difficult. And of course that, you know, bad homework led to beatings, and, you know, I mean, it all sounds absolutely unbelievable. Why? Beatings on the bottom very rarely, but beatings on the hand frequently, you know, and very painful. I didn't really terribly enjoy grammar school, and the sports fields were miles away, and one bicycled to them, which was nice in the summer, but awful in the winter.
I don't know whether I enjoyed
or disenjoyed. You know, I mean, one just accepts, isn't it? I mean, I was saying silly story, but I discovered that the place we used to stay out in Venice when we were young, called the Casa Frollo, that my Italian friend said, oh, I stay there as well, you see. And I knew it was closed. So I took the water bus and got out and had a look, and it's being reconstructed for sanitary reasons. And so I talked to her a little bit about it. I said, what was fantastic was a period of your life that you just existed, you know. That is, the question of being happy or unhappy didn't arise in a way. You just like the cat, you know, you're just being. And although the obviously moments of revelation and pleasure, they're not conscious at the time, you know.
Don't you think the children today are, in fact, much more conscious? And I think that's what's interesting, don't you think?
They're better prepared, I think, is one of the other things, you know, because I...
But they do think today that they have choices, don't they? Don't teenagers today think that? Anyway, that's a philosophical...
I'll have to ask. I mean, yes, I mean, maybe that. I mean, my eldest child, Simon, who's now 43, when he went as a student to Istanbul, he sent a one-line postcard and it just said, I've arrived 50 years too late. You know, well, that's a statement of real insight.
Quite.
You know, I mean, I think they're probably right, you know.
But anyway, you at that time, which was perfectly within the period, you accepted everything that happened.
Yeah, I accepted everything. And the things that I can remember enjoying and walking home, you know, in the gutter, and in the summer when the tar melted, you know, and you leave this one. Fantastic. You know, there were moments of pleasure. And what else? But, you know, there weren't such things as school trips or all that. And I had fantastic holidays with my parents to the seaside, which was Whitby. And that opens a door to endless pleasures, you know. I mean, you know, all the things like beach cricket and all that, and being with other children. And it's a fantastic place, you know, still for me.
Did you stay in a boarding house, or did
we stayed in a boarding house, and the family of fishermen. That is the fishing in Whitby is done in two ways. One, inshore fishing, where they in a cobble, you know, where you put out a line with hooks with mussels on them or whatever. So, and then the bigger boats, still timber, wooden boats with a wooden I don't know what it's called, but the thing where the steering wheel is. And they went out for longer periods. And the family of the boarding house I remember best, people were called Theka, T-H-E-A-K-E-R. And the father was a skipper of one of these boats, and the boys worked on the boats, sailed, fished with the boat. Therefore, in a way, they're in a kind of superficial way, you know, you had a contact with one of the real basic trades, you know, and about the romanticism about Whitby for me is bound up two or three ways, you know, both with the place and even the architecture. You know, because...
What did you visit while you were there?
What did we do? Swimming. There was a swimming pool already, freezing cold water. And the families had beach huts, you know. And then the mothers and fathers would knit, not the fathers. Fathers would play beach cricket. And there were enough of us. Like family, I was an only child, but one of the families had three or four and the other had two. With the fathers, there was enough to play beach cricket, which is the principal thing I remember, actually, because as the tide receded, it became very flat, and the beach was not especially crowded, you know. Now then, you're back to the business of the social class thing, you know. That is that the. I don't think that working people got any holiday.
Well, I was going to say, which still, I mean.
You know, therefore, they would come down on day trips, and indeed, then you have to have some architecture. The business of the piers, there wasn't one at Whitby, but along the coast there were piers, was made because there was a slump in people who produced the railway lines after the crash of the railway. The 1860s, and they turned to the steel people themselves, financing and building piers at the ends of lines that led from the industrial cities to the coast.
Do you know, I never knew that.
Never knew that until recently.
How interesting.
And therefore, it became a kind of machine, you know. The railway went from Middlesbrough to Redcar or to Scarborough, and could therefore carry X people to it. Therefore it was worthwhile turning from making steel into railway lines, into building, and then the profitability of the pier would flow back to the... But that was... That theory, or that practice, was built round the day trip idea. Therefore, back to the non-crowding on the beach, The people, the day trippers came, on the whole, were in one area, and the lower middle and middle class were in another area. And of course the lower middle class stayed in boarding houses, and the middle, there were hotels. Both, I mean, like all this same, the period before the peers came was the kind of the trying to turn seaside places into spas.
Yes.
You know, there's that unfinished novel of Jane Austen called Sanderton. You know, about built around that idea. Well, both Scarborough and Whitby had terraces and, you know, built an anticipation of.
Anyway, you had fun on the beach.
Oh, yes. I'm giving you the architecture now.
But when did you decide to become an architect?
Well, I'm sorry, there's two interviews in 1 week. It's too much. But because I was 15 in 1939, and the war, supposing I did a school certificate in June, in September the war came, and therefore there was for my parents the business of what do you, you know, do and, as they lived through the First War, they could see it was going to last forever, and I would be called up into the army. And did one try to get some of one's professional training before that? My father had a school friend who was an architect, and I think probably the only architect in the town, and he asked him his advice, because as I only was good at English and drawing, and they couldn't perceive a person being able to make his living as an artist.
Architect?
Which at that time, which...
As an artist.
The architect was a kind of practical, you know, trade. I mean, where you could probably make a living. So they decided that. And then this man said that the apprenticeship, it wasn't called that. I'm never going to remember the proper name. You know, to be articled was dying out, and people were going to college, and there was a school of architecture at Newcastle, and because of the war they were making similar calculations. You know, they wouldn't have any people because they would all be in the army, therefore they dropped the age of admissions. So I went with my father to see the reader in architecture, said I could start, and because I was just barely 16, you know. In fact, I might have even been to see him when I was still 15, you know.
Wow. Well, well, wow, well.
Wow. Wow.
He's really got that British matter-of-factness down pat.
I feel like there's absolutely no reason to doubt anything he said, except for the situations where he tells us that he does not remember and that therefore we can doubt what he remembers because he has told us that that is the time for doubting to be engaged. Yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, there was one thing that he said a couple of times that I think is really true is that, like, it's always too late. When you get interested in these, like, family questions, it's always too late. You know, because the people you could have asked are gone by the time you realize that that's something you wanted to know about. And that's certainly something that I've been worried about lately. I know, just because, you know, I don't see my parents very often. And so I'm thinking, you know, like, well, you know, there's probably a lot of stuff that they've experienced that I should probably find out about. Like, recently I figured out where exactly in Ukraine my family is from. It's, like, amazing I've lived this long and not known anything about that, for example. You know?
Yeah, my parents and their cousins and siblings are going through that moment where they're frantically trying to piece it together before their own minds go. I'm getting a lot of updates, which, much to my surprise, I recently learned last month that when my dad's side of the family moved from, like, somewhere in the Midwest to California, mm-hmm. they settled, like, two blocks from where I live now.
No way.
Yeah, they on Los Robles. I live on Orange Grove. Like, mm-hmm. I could walk there in a few minutes. And that there's, like, a totally mediocre Italian restaurant up the street from us called Pinocchio's that we went to early. Mm-hmm. We moved in and have not been back since, partially because of COVID and partially because it's not that amazing.
And the name sounds great.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing because my father's cousin sent me a picture of my great-great-grandfather, who was a postman of the city of Pasadena, standing in front of Pinocchio's. And I called Pinocchio's and asked if it used to be a post office because it reminded me of the facade. And they're like, yeah, we don't know anything about that. But then my dad found an old, like, a blog entry on some Pasadena history buff. And sure enough, it was a post office from, like, 1920 to 1935 or something like that.
Wow.
So I was like, oh, wow. I ate pasta, and they have... The main problem with Pinocchio's is lots of televisions. So I ate pasta and, like, watched an NBA game or something with Ella. In the very space that my great-great-grandfather used to sort the mail.
Wow. That's cool.
I know. So I'm glad they're piecing this stuff together.
Yeah, somewhat. You know what I mean? But then there's some things that, of course, they'll never know.
True.
Right? I think it is, like, such a crazy, just reflecting on some of Peter's memories, you know, his family becoming theosophists, almost like it was just, like, something very normal to do. And, like, I've always thought of that as being, like, kind of a pretty fringe thing. But that, like, you know, there was a significant number of people in the sort of lower bourgeois class becoming theosophists, you know, and, like... what it would mean to be vegetarian in early 20th century England, which I don't imagine had a lot of fresh fruit and veg in general, you know?
Right.
Just sounds just, like, challenging things to imagine, you know? I'd say, like, the yeah. Do you know any theosophists?
I don't know any. Yeah, at all.
Right. Yeah, and I know people who you know, there's, like, various sort of flavors, I guess, of, like, sub theosophy that are out and around, you know, because it's influenced all you know, a lot of what we would call, like, the New Age movement and stuff like that, right?
Sure.
Like, lots of that stuff comes from sort of, like, the first sort of truly, I feel like it's not the first, but it's, like, you know, among the first truly syncretic. You know, it doesn't matter that this is Hinduism and that's, you know, some sort of reconstructed version of Egyptian mythology. You know, like, it's fine to put all that stuff together. We're just going to go do that, you know. Focus on your breath, dot, 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 you know. I feel like that's, you know, theosophy sort of, like, paved the way for everyone else to do that kind of stuff. You know, like, Madame Blavatsky walked so that... you know, yoga with Adrian could run or whatever. But, like, Right. But like, so I feel like in some ways, like, you know, theosophy is now like a stew that we sort of soak in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. There's that one Theosophical Society place in Guerneville, I guess. And it's the only sort of like theosophist. It's like a theosophical campsite for, I guess, theosophical retreats. And you see it on your way into the national park there, like north of Guerneville in Northern California. And that's like the most, that's the closest I've come, you know, to encountering in the flesh theosophists, is presumably like a building some of them move through. Although I guess like Steiner schools are also sort of theosophical or whatever as well in some, you know, in some dimension. But yeah, I don't know. It is like pretty weird to just be like, wow, this whole moment did exist.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Oh, geez. I mean, I wish I'd had a bit more coffee before this.
Yeah.
Talking. It was,
it's late at night.
It's late. And, Peter has a unique style, I'd say, of, delivery. But I honestly must say I didn't know Peter's work before he came by to talk, and I'm shocked after spending this last hour with Peter that he and his wife, what they did to architecture, with architecture.
Yeah, that they are the lords of early brutalism.
And having visited London for the first time as an adult recently, that how much of an impact that movement had on that city. The pendulum swinging as far as it could in that moment from what was there before.
Well, I think, to be fair, German bombing played a significant role.
Sure, but, you know, it wasn't like they then built, like, the houses, you know, the structures from Thailand or something. Like, they went into the straight
right.
post-industrial concrete brutalist architecture. Because I feel like the brutalist buildings in New York City that I think of, they kind of stick out, whereas the ones in London almost make sense.
Yeah, they're all generally on the same scale as the buildings around them,
yeah,
kind of thing, and have similar sort of repeating patterns and stuff as well.
And sprinkled about enough that you don't really question them too much.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what the deal, like, you know, what the stuff that got blown up that these buildings replaced. Mm-hmm. At that time, you wonder if a map of all the brutalist buildings in London is a map of previously all the like buildings of military significance in London. You know, it's a reverse map of German things that the Germans wanted to remove or something. Does that make sense? What's this here for? Oh, it's like, you know, why is this here? Well, they bombed the other thing. Well, why did they bomb that thing? And, you know, they bombed it because that's where, you know, they were trying to break the Enigma code or something, or, you know, whatever.
Well, it's a bit of a taunt to future aggressors, because it's like, well, if it was easy enough for them to blow that up, try this one.
Yeah.
Try blowing this concrete block up.
I mean, truly, I think that was actually part of the appeal.
Yeah,
to be honest, actually, it was like, it was very sturdy. It was also something that could be done with a more mechanized process than rebuilding the buildings that had been built previously. Because in addition to the buildings having been destroyed, England was in severe economic crisis after basically, you know, fighting two world wars, and then on top of that as well, like there was a pretty severe lack of craftspeople. Because many of the craftsmen in England had been killed in the war.
Right.
Which led to them sort of asking their former colonial subjects from like Jamaica to move over. But then lately they were like, oh, it turns out you never naturalized, so we're going to deport you now as a 70-year-old man, which has been a huge scandal in England lately as well. But anyway, England's colonial peccadilloes aside, You know, I think there's a few reasons why brutalism was what took off, because it was easier to build. You know, once you built the forms, you could just pour it together, I suppose, mm-hmm. as opposed to having someone cutting and pointing brick. And you didn't have anyone making, you couldn't get enough bricks or anything anyway. So, like, the concrete was easy to mix up comparatively, I suppose. But yeah, no, I think it was castle-y. Like, I think there's also an element of it where it feels English.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it is pretty shocking that someone so laid back is such a polarizing figure
right.
in architectural history.
It's very subdued and reserved.
Yeah, well, I know that the current the new king, King Charles, is quite opposed to Peter's work. For example, is not a fan. It is what it is.
Mom a big fan?
The thing that people like so much about Queen Elizabeth II is that she let so few of her opinions be known.
Yeah.
And I think if there is a secret code to being well liked, it's not telling people very much about what you actually think about stuff,
right?
Especially
when you like de facto matter a lot.
Yeah, but then don't as well. Yeah, I think it's a funny position, right? Because it's like, of course, it doesn't really matter what she thinks, but. I think being someone of very few specific opinions has been if there's one lesson we can take from the death of Her Majesty, it's that often the less said the better when you're on the record. So I don't think we have any idea what she thought of. I mean, here's one thing. After the war, I imagine some royal properties must have been in disrepair. And they were not rebuilt in brutalist style.
Very true.
You know, and I think there's a certain tendency to historicism that doesn't exist in previous eras. Like, you know, there would be a castle that was built in the 1100s that then gets rebuilt in the 1500s. That, you know, and these structures exist in England and are royal properties and stuff, right? They have different generations of building in them. But somehow... in the late 1800s, they just stopped, and they refused to have new architectural styles. So, make of that what you will. But they certainly, there isn't like a giant windowless concrete. That would be so cool. That would be so like Dune style. If, the king, the now king, but the queen of England, you know, just emerged from sort of like a giant, opaque, you know, cuboid form with like tiny slit windows in it somehow. I think that would just be fantastic.
Or even if just like the Corgi's house, which I think is substantial because of how many there are, was just some slab brutalist architecture.
Yeah, the Corgis all live in an Alison and Peter Smithson designed Corgi house.
Yeah. Corgi bunker. Yeah. Bunker Corgi.
Yeah. Well, you know, she would want her little dogs to survive nuclear assault, so...
It's true.
Yes. Well, all right. With that, folks, good night.
Good morning, Chinatown.